This is the birthday of L. Berry Hobbs, The Drifters, Stand By Me, on this day. But let's talk about Stand By Me. We're going to talk about what's going on in our world with our guests here today. We are joined by Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence and Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Hopkins University. Welcome back, Lester. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
E.R. Shipp, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, journalist in residence, and associate professor of journalism here at the Morgan State University School of Global Journalism. Good to have you back with us, Shipp.
Good morning.
Tyrone Keyes, author, public affairs strategist, and public relations expert, back in the studio again. Good to have you here, Tyrone.
Good morning, Mark.
And I want to encourage all of you to join us here at 410-319-8888. Email your thoughts to talk at steinershow.org. That's talk at steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, and please leave comments at the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page, 410-319-8888. Well, there is a lot going on in this world today. So many pieces we can cover. And I'd like to see what our listeners think of 410-319-8888. We'll start nationally, internationally, and then we'll move into some very tragic local news and talk about what that means and what we as a community can do about the situations that took the life of this young girl in our community. But let's begin with President Barack Obama, who's now convening this African Leaders Conference in Washington, D.C., and his comment, which they took in some ways out of context, but he made the comment nevertheless, that we tortured some folks. And the question of what we are learning about happened during the Bush administration, we'll know and we'll not know. What's your reaction to this? What's your reaction to this out there? 410-319-8888. Tyrone, you've been missing for a while. You're back in action with us. Glad to have you here, so why don't you start?
Well, it's nothing new. It's not a new allegation, and it's certainly not a new practice for the United States or any other government. I mean, if you can go all the way back to the Civil War, and even beyond that, to the Revolutionary War, to accusations of torture. We're a little queasy about it these days in the United States, although we still have practices where we will take an enemy combatant to a country that is not as queasy about it as we are and allow, you know, them to conduct interrogations. So that's kind of an underhanded way to farm it out, and we do still engage in those practices in those ways. I don't know if anyone's familiar with rendition. And
we've got that word often, rendition, taking prisoners from their countries, picking them up and taking them to hidden black box prisons.
Absolutely.
To be tortured.
Absolutely.
And confined. Right.
And, you know, torture in any other country doth smell as sweet. You know, you have to ask yourself. So it is certainly a question of whether or not you get accurate information from an individual that's under that type of duress. Are they telling you things just to, you know, stop the pain at some point? But then you have to also look at it from the standpoint of what the president said has the convenience of looking at it after the fact through the lens of history. If he was given an opportunity to prevent another 9/11 style attack, and one of the ways that he could do that was to engage in some sort of torture, would he do it? And I guess that's a question that only he could answer, and I guess that's a question that the listeners would have to entertain for themselves.
Shipp?
Well, he actually indicated some sympathy with those who had to make the decision earlier. So, as you said, it's not anything new that the revelation that there had been torture in the name of the United States. But I think one can see how in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, there was such hysteria that a number of things were probably done that we regret. And the president's position seems to be kind of one of truth and reconciliation. You know, we have to get at the pain of what we did wrong and figure out how to make amends and go forward.
Lester Spence.
I have a slightly different take. I'm really interested in the way that rhetoric, whether it's uttered by political officials, and actually particularly if it's uttered by political officials or people who aren't political officials necessarily, how they can be used to actually create create or or peel back political rights. So when the President of the United States basically acknowledges that political officials engage in torture, something that's actually illegal. You know, if you can think about it broadly, it's illegal, not just for human rights law. It's illegal in the United States. What he's doing is he's giving people who believe that torture should be wrong political ammunition to actually push harder against for a number of things, including sanctions against the people who engage in terroristic acts. So yes, he did. He did express sympathy for 9/11. Yes, the U.S. has a long history of torturing folk, going all the way back to its inception. But every time a political official, particularly the President of the United States, basically acknowledges not just that torture was committed, but that a previous president of the United States actually engaged in that act, then that's something that we should take seriously. And to a certain extent, we should be surprised about, because we can easily imagine him, just as a number of his predecessors, just blowing it off.
Well, I don't think he would blow it off necessarily, but I, to your point that now people can raise the issue much more strongly and demand sanctions, I think that's where President Obama will become Obama. He would fall back on the sympathetic position and not take any real action. So his acknowledging that there was torture is probably about as far as you're going to go with him.
Well, let me say one more thing. I've noticed that I'm putting the weight of politics not on the president, but on people who mobilize, right? So you're absolutely right. Obama becomes Obama, but Obama's the president. Technically, he's just the guy who presides. Well, we know it doesn't really work like that, but he's technically the guy who presides. I wouldn't expect Obama to do anything other than speak, but that speaking can then be used by people who can move, right? So I'm putting the weight of the responsibility should be on Obama, but the responsibility is really going to be on people who try to use this.
I want to kind of, before we open the phones here, 410-319-8888, also write to us here at Talk, T-A-L-K, Talk Capital at steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. And Lane, hold on, we're going to come to your call. I'm going to raise a couple of the subjects, then we'll open the floodgates of the phones, let people kind of comment on all this stuff. Given all that, we're seeing now the Republican Party is under Bonner, is suing the president. And it was interesting. Two things I'll just throw out here and see what you all think. I mean, one is that, you know, I've seen, and as he's looked at the number of presidents who have taken these executive actions and more, Obama's in the middle of the list, not at the top of the list or the bottom of the list in terms of taking executive actions. George Bush was at much higher rate. Franklin D. Roosevelt was off the charts with executive orders. Different presidents had different numbers. The other part was interesting. I saw a clip that I meant to get my producers to play, but I did not, which was a clip of President Barack Obama in a debate in 2008 with John McCain, where he said one of the things he was going to do differently than George W. Bush was to lessen the number of executive actions and orders by the White House, because President Bush was overstepping his bounds with Congress. As a constitutional lawyer, he was talking and was saying that I won't do this as President of the United States of America.
Wouldn't do it as much.
No, he basically said he was basically saying that he would not. This is constitutionally really questionable,
right,
is what he was saying in that quote. And I found that interesting, just to see that quote in juxtaposition to what the reality is today when you become president. So, what are our thoughts about that? You started, so I'm going to let you lead off, then we'll go around the room. What are your thoughts here?
Well, given what he faces with this Congress, and given the agenda that he had coming into office, it's understandable that he would have to resort to the use of executive actions to get anything done. It's not something that one wishes were the case, but the reality is that's pretty much the only way he's going to get anything moving in this particular, during his presidency. So I think that's, we're going to see more of that probably now. Because there are a few issues he can have some impact on while Congress is away. And I think he's emboldened by that, and he's also more frustrated. So I think we're going to probably see more.
More executive. Actually.
More.
Yeah, I think we're on a slippery slope. Bill Clinton, as a matter of fact, is the leader in modern times of the executive action, writing the executive actions, executive orders, rather. Mm-hmm. As far as the suit is concerned, I actually think that the suit is a mistake, because if you look at what they're suing him for, they're suing him for, you know, drafting an executive order that delays the employer mandate of Obamacare. So, in effect, the Republicans are suing the president because he's not implementing Obamacare, a piece of legislation that the Republicans rail against. I think that they have forgotten, they pretty much abdicated their power as a co-equal branch of government and want to throw it into the judicial, when in fact they control the power of the purse. If they're so outraged, they do control Congress. They could stop the funding, but they want to play political games, and they feel as though that might not be as politically palatable. With regard to our acceptance of executive orders coming from any president in either party, I think we have to be careful. Frustration of an executive should not be the litmus test for that executive making an end run around Congress. We do have three co-equal branches of government. People get it kind of confused in the presidency, thinking it is the most powerful simply because one individual embodies an entire branch. But in effect, he is co-equal to the other two branches. So I think that we need to speak out, all of us, against executive orders. And I think that suit is pretty ridiculous.
Dr. Spence.
I agree with the second statement. I'm not sure I agree with the first. So quick numbers. Ronald Reagan drafted 381 executive orders. Bill Clinton drafted 364 executive orders. George Bush the second, George W., drafted 291. And Barack Obama's only at 183, right?
That's 2 years ago.
Right. He's got it a couple of years ago, but his tendency, going back to the last discussion, his tendency is actually to use rhetoric as opposed to pushing hard for policy. Right. So even if that number goes up, I don't see that number approaching George W. even, who is much more aggressive in his ideas about what the president should do. I think that I do agree that this is kind of another example of the Republicans kind of stepping outside the traditional bounds of democracy to get a piece of legislation, a kind of kill that they couldn't kill off any other way. They couldn't kill it off through a presidential election. They couldn't kill it off through votes. They couldn't kill it off through the Supreme Court. So this is kind of another attempt. And it's interesting to kind of juxtapose this against other examples, against, for example, Bush's conduct in the Iraq War, which was arguably illegal and unconstitutional. But with that said, I think that particularly given how obstructionist this Republican Congress has been, we actually should call for the president to use executive orders more rather than less, right? Because there are, particularly because every vehicle that every traditional vehicle that we have, again, elections, legislation, the court, right, they're saying that we're on the right path. So if you've actually got a body that's willing to ignore every element of traditional government, a traditional democracy, then no, you use the executive order to go around them. And then you make the Republicans make the hard choice to actually take a stance against that. That's what you do. And I wish that I saw him having Ronald Reagan-like numbers as far as executive orders are concerned.
We have to give a very brief break and come right back. We're going to come back to Lane and Mary, who are calling in. We'll read this tweet from Jolien Ivey, who is tweeting about one of our topics, and we'll see what she has to say as well. And what you say at 410-319-8888. And write to us at talkatsteinershow.org. And we're going to break with It Could Happen to You by Herb Ellis. the great jazz. Oh, Herb Ellis, the great jazz guitarist, born on this day in 1921. We just play that for the last half an hour. I'd be happy. We'll be right back. Ellis, to just cool us all out for a minute. We can use that in this crazy world. If you ever need to chill, he's a good man to listen to. Dr. Lester Spence is with us, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence and Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. E.R. Schiff, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and Associate Professor here of Journalism at the Morgan State University's School of Global Journalism. Tyrone Keyes, author, public affairs strategist, and public relations expert. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Did you have something to say very quick, Tyrone?
Just following up on Les's point from earlier. You know, you got to be real careful what you wish for because administrations change hands. So if we set precedents that presidents should, basically rule by this executive order and run around the Congress, the people's house, then you got to look at the future and think that one day maybe a president of the opposite party will be elected. And I wonder, will individuals be so willing to, entertain these executive orders then?
Well, the thing is, I started out with those numbers in order to emphasize that we've already had that. Right. So Reagan transforms government. He transforms almost every aspect of how we think government should operate through executive board orders, 381 of them. The only way to actually reestablish a mode of government that goes back to dealing with issues of inequality is to use the executive order. So, yes, you're absolutely right. But I look at this as not establishing a radical precedent. Right? Again, Barack Obama has 183. Ronald Reagan has has 200 more. I'm looking at this as peeling back that radical transformation by using executive order.
So let me jump here to get to the phones, I promise, and also get to this tweet by Julian Ivey, because I want to get quick comments on you all about Julian Ivey's tweet. And Lester Spence was definitely engaged in what she tweeted about, so we'll talk about that in a minute. But 410-319-8888. Let's go to the phones. And Lane, you've been holding on for about 15 minutes. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, sir. How do you do?
Very well. Welcome.
Okay. My comment would be, why do we not hold our elected officials responsible for their actions? The torturing of POWs and detainees, first in Afghanistan, that was in the heat of the moment, shortly after 9/11, and people go wild, but 2 years later, we're in Iraq, and not only are we still doing it, we're escalating it, and. With the president's approval, Rumsfeld involved with it. CIA director, I think it was Morse, was involved with it. All these people involved with it, how come they are not being made available in The Hague for prosecution? I mean, people died with them doing this stuff. A lot of people died, not just a handful, but a lot of people died, and a whole lot more were tortured, and these people need to be held responsible for
okay.
it. And it's safe. It makes us safer when we stand up and say, yeah, our our people did this, and they have to be held responsible. It makes us more safe when we do that. If we just cavalierly just do this stuff and let these people walk, then we are less safe.
Let's get one more thought on this. 410-319-8888. Thank you, Lane, so much for your thoughts. Mary, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Mary.
In the same vein that the last caller was speaking about, my thoughts and question was, we actually did know that this torture was going on. There was different organizations throughout the world, including Amnesty International, the Quakers Association, which is not coming to mind at this time, ACLU. I actually had the opportunity to go to, I cannot remember the name of this, the town in North Carolina where rendition flights were leaving constantly during the Bush administration with ties to Halliburton and the Black Box Company, that we knew the documentation was being gathered by different organizations throughout the world, but these organizations are looked at as radical by mainstream media and even the higher echelons of education. But we don't want to actually delve into it, and then after the fact, we're like, this torture was going on, which is completely heinous. And if we actually stepped up and tried to evaluate the information that was coming in off the ground from different sources at the time, we could have probably stopped some of it from occurring and continuing to occur. And I just want to know from the panel, why are organizations like Amnesty International or the ACLU sometimes just written off? Oh, they're just too radical. And they're not taken as the information that they're gathering
right.
really seriously and actually researched.
Mary, thanks so much for your call, 410-319-8888. So let's wrestle with it. Sometimes I think, and this was going to say this in jest, but it's not in jest. I think it's serious more. I think about it, that when you talk about people being brought to The Hague for war crimes of any kind, they are usually very small countries. They're never major countries, not the United States. Most countries in Western Europe, they're not China. They're not brought ever. Rwanda, Serbia, easy to kind of attack and get at and bring those folks out as examples of what we don't accept anymore. But I think that's in some ways how this always plays out. And what do we think about what our callers were saying? And who would like to begin?
Well, Tyrone. The young lady that was just on, she mentioned
Mary.
She mentioned, I believe her question centered around, you know, why isn't an organization like the ACLU, when they make a charge, taken seriously? I actually think that, from my perspective, Mary, the ACLU is taken seriously. Now, the ACLU is in a bad position because they get a bad rap no matter what they do. 50% of the people love it or hate it. But I think that if you look at the cases that they've tackled, it's pretty nonpartisan. But as far as the whole torture issue is concerned, Americans are interested in eating the sausage, but we're not interested in seeing how it's made. And there's a colloquialism that goes, freedom isn't free. Well, neither is security. And it's a dangerous world. And I'm not here suggesting that torture be the only method of eliciting information, but I do understand, I'm a realist, and I understand that in certain cases, when time is of the essence and lives are at stake, then that is something you may have to do. And I'm not one that's willing to sacrifice the lives of many for the lives of one. And I'm able to admit that.
Ship, and then I'm going to go to Lester on this, and then I'll have a different subject before we hit something new.
I wish that the press were more aggressive when it comes to looking at some of these allegations of wrongdoing and not wait until after the fact, when there is an official acknowledgement in the form of a report or in a president saying, yes, we tortured some folks, maybe we can begin to start just looking at the track record of these organizations that do come to us saying that something wrong is happening. But the ACLU, the NAACP, from their inception have always been considered to be, by many, to be too radical to be taken seriously. They're too partisan to be taken seriously. Their track records over the years, though, say something differently. And I think the press now has enough evidence to be able to come and use some of these organizations as credible sources for at least raising issues better than we are now.
Lester.
Yeah, power. So the reason why it doesn't happen that often, reason why a variety of institutions didn't act at the time is power. Recently, I think a Salon.com reported a story from the New York Times saying that an official in the New York Times basically acknowledged that they gave the United States government a pass after 9/11, that they basically stopped serving as a check on government and were basically serving as a propaganda arm. I don't see that trend. I don't see that trend stopping anytime soon. That is, in the moment, at every time when power really starts to exert itself, it's very, very, very hard for people, for institutions, or for people with radically different voices to actually have that voice become used as a check on that power. But fortunately, every now and then, what happens is, with some lag time, we can revisit those moments, like we're doing now, and say, you know what? What we did was wrong, and then try to establish safeguards. Now, those safeguards are never perfect. Those safeguards almost never work the way they're supposed to do, but they actually do at least a little bit to make it harder for power to exert itself in the same way the next time around.
Another question here. This is Julian Ivey sent this piece in that I think is important to just kind of look at for just a moment, just given the NABJ conference and what Lester Spence used to spend part of his time doing. Julian Ivey tweeted in, as we know, the state delegate who ran for lieutenant governor with Mr. Gansler. She said, "Losing Michelle Martin's unique forum is a real loss, still in mourning." Now, in Boston, the National Association of Black Journalists gave a thumbs down to National Public Radio, because the cancellation of Tell Me More, the whole question of race and representation on public radio.
Yes, that was something that was widely applauded by members who were in attendance at the convention. It had not just to do with the cancellation of Michelle Martin's show, but with a sense that NPR is not living up to its express desire to encourage diversity in its staffing and in its programming. I'm not sure what a thumbs down will do other than get us to talk about it and maybe shame NPR into doing something. But they would come back and say that it's not NPR per se, but it's the member stations who have the power to determine which programs to carry and when to carry them. So the battle, it seems to me, has to be not just with the corporate level NPR, but with those stations that have that power.
Lester?
I saw Jolene last week. I was there for the last taping on Friday, and I went live to NPR to take my last, like, Dad's Roundtable bit Tuesday, and I saw Jolene on both occasions. I'm actually in mourning myself, and one of the reasons I decided to come on, I mean, I'm the Center for Emerging Media person in residence, but I ain't been in residence in a while, technically. But one of the reasons I've come on is not just to give a shout out to you, but to kind of express or kind of go back to using this as a venue for public statement. I think that one of the things, so at the end of the live taping, what happened was they had this event in NPR's headquarters. You know, they set us out with food and everything, and then a number of NPR executives got up and gave speeches. And in the middle of that, Michelle gave a speech, and she didn't know she was going to be asked to speak. And I think maybe if she knew, she probably would have tried to get on last rather than in the middle. And what she said is incredibly important. She said that, you know, what she wanted that day to do, that Friday moment, to be is a time of celebration, to celebrate what we had accomplished, right? To eat, to drink, to be merry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But tomorrow we have to fight, right? Tomorrow you have to fight. And she was speaking to all the Tell Me More folks in the room, many of whom had taken jobs in other shows. And she was basically arguing that they continue the battle that she took up and other people before her took up at NPR. I disagree strongly with the idea that the weight of canceling Tell Me More should be put on individual affiliates. I think that if NPR's executive staff, which actually changed over, if they had expressed a commitment to diversifying NPR's programmatic offerings, then Tell Me More still be on the air, right? Yeah. I mean, if we consistently rely on the market to serve black interests, we will never ever win, and NPR executives have to be aware of that.
You know, I think this is a person who's been on public radio for the last 21 years. I have been calling for national public radio, as my wife and I were talking about last night, and it hasn't happened, though I'm going to reach out to Michelle and others and really make a major call for this, that at the next four national meetings that National Public Radio has, that they wrestle with race and demographics and public radio and what they really stand for. When I heard the new president of NPR on Michelle's show last week, Valerie was just beside herself, that's my wife, listening to him saying, you know, that he was basically saying that diversity in some ways depends on the marketplace. And that's utter madness, because you'll never have it that way, because Terry Gross can have millions of dollars in corporate underwriting that Michelle will have a hard time getting for Tell Me More, given the nature of this country. And there is no real commitment there, I think. As you remember, when Juan Williams was fired, whether you agree or disagree that his firing is not the question I'm raising, when Juan Williams was fired, he was the only black male reporter at National Public Radio.
There's a problem.
There's a problem.
If me as a professor, right? My job is as a professor, but me and Jimmy Israel have been the most consistent black male voices on NPR, and we're just two guys. And it's National Public Radio. That's absurd. I mean, the more I talk about it, the more I get pissed. That's why I've been kind of sort of silent on this issue.
Well, we'll come back to this issue in a couple of weeks. We're going to take a brief break now. And are we taking a break or just rolling? I think we're just rolling. Lawrence Brown's going to come in. And we will tackle this in greater depth. And I'm going to ask Lester come back and Ship and others to wrestle with public radio and public media and race in our country and the demographics of this country and who we are and what we're becoming. And I think it's a very important subject. And I personally am just devastated by the loss of her program. I think that not just because it was on the station, but because Michelle Martin was an incredible talk show host. Her questions were amazing. The way she listened was amazing. The kind of people she brought on were amazing. NPR has a hard time finding people of color of any kind in this country to talk about issues other than race. She didn't have a problem finding them and bringing them on the airwaves. I mean, she lent a lot, and I think that her voice would be deeply missed. And I think it's a real tragedy that Tell Me More was ended by National Public Radio. A travesty, I think. But that's it. I want to switch gears here. Are we taking a break or not? No, let's roll. So let's do this. So let's move into a new area. Lawrence Brown's going to jump in the studio in a minute, but I really want to switch gears here and have our listeners join us at 410-319-8888 and write to me here talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook page, The Mark Steiner Show, 410-319-8888. Over the weekend, Mackenzie Elliott, a three-year-old child, was murdered, torn down by a stray bullet in Waverly in one of our communities. And it devastated that family clearly. I mean, I read what the father was saying. He was on his way home. Parents always do this, but I mean, if I got just a few minutes early to take her swimming, she might be alive. But, you know, but he was coming home to take his little girl swimming. All of us who have children or you have children in our lives even don't. I mean, just the idea of losing a child is too much to contend with for me, for Lester, for anybody else with babies around them. But the question is, what do we do here? You know, we posted talking back and forth on Facebook. And I'll harken back to something from yesterday year for a moment, my yesterday year, and the peer of the Black Panther Party. And I remember very well that while the Panthers how they were pictured in the press, what they also did was say on the corner to pimps, to drug dealers, to violent actors in the corner, we're going to give you a chance to join us for the revolution to make change in America. And if you don't, you're our enemy because you're killing our people. We can't have it. So let's just bounce. Can we reflect a minute where we are? I mean, it's the death of this poor child, but it also is a really much larger dilemma.
Yeah, I claim Detroit whenever I come on the show, but I actually grew up in a working class black town outside of Detroit called Inkster, and something happened that was in some way similar. Someone was actually more criminal, right? And then a guy had a beef with another guy, went to the guy's crib, shot his kid in front of him. Killed his kid in front of him, and then I think he shot the dad, right? I mean, it's like that's absolutely what's happening is we're having kind of a long-standing breakdown of the ties that bind, and that breakdown is driven by kind of the drug economy. So as far as I would have taken. I think what we need now is not necessarily that same approach, that is where Black Panthers or some group of folk get together and they basically wage war on drug dealers. For a number of reasons, I think that approach would be kind of problematic. But I think what we should do is fight for more sane drug policy to take the crime out of the drug economy. And I think if we take the crime back out of the drug economy, then these types of actions are less likely to take place. Because what we're talking about are basically competing drug firms. And the only way drug firms can establish new territory is by waging war against one another. It would be equivalent of McDonald's franchises using guns to figure out where they're going to situate each other, or McDonald's and Burger King franchises. That's what it is.
So let me turn now. But Dr. Lawrence Brown's in the studio joining us for this conversation and our next conversation on Ebola. But we're also joined by Rob Drouse, who is a member of the 300-Man March Engagement Unit, lives in the Waverly neighborhood where this took place. Rob, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
And you all can join us here, 410-319-8888. I mean, just share with us what you've seen, what's happening in the Waverly neighborhood, and what has happened since the tragic murder of this young baby.
I've lived in Waverly pretty much since I've been in Baltimore. I've been there actually about 5 years now. I'm in my house, a block and a half away from where the shooting took place. And, you know, it's just, you know, obviously the grief and the tragedy and the sadness of it all, you know, there's just no words to describe that, you know, the feelings that just kind of shook through the community. But, you know, just kind of with some days to reflect on the tragedy, and especially with having the mayor and some police officials come out the day after for a press conference, you know, what was going through my head that whole day leading up to the press conference was, you know, it's been 24 hours, and the only thing I expect to hear from this press conference is that the shooter has been caught. And it's not even the onus being on the city and the police, but, I mean, I cruise that strip of Old York every day just to leave the neighborhood. And, you know, Waverly as a whole, there are always people outside. We've got a lot of families in the neighborhood. A lot of, you know, families that are living there, owning the homes, a lot of kids playing outside. And, we can count just dozens of people outside, you know, on their stoops, chatting with neighbors all the time, you know, morning, evening. So, you know, with this problem that's been reported of, you know, youth in the city being out in the corners and this and that and whatever led to someone doing a drive-by up Old York Road, there are plenty of witnesses. And whoever was in that car with the shooter, whoever was outside seeing it happen, whoever the target was, you know, clearly not this three-year-old, you know, there are people who know who did this. And it's almost as great of a crime for them not to say something as whoever this person is that has to, I can't even say sleep at night because I couldn't tell you, Mark, if I did something like this, even accidentally, that I'd be sleeping. It's inexcusable that whatever led to, you know, communities of mistrust and police and this and that, and we can talk about this for days, but there's no acceptable justification for a three-year-old to lose their life and not have an outrage, just a, you know, a community that rejects this at the fundamental level and demands a justice beyond Facebook and Twitter and a press conference and some firing.
So let me turn to Dr. Lawrence Brown, who's one of the guests here in the studio as well, and we're going to go over into 11 o'clock a little bit to finish this part of the conversation. We don't have time because I think it's important for us to wrestle with. I mean, Dr. Lester Spence just talked about the drug war fueling this and this mercantile illegal underground that fuels this violence. I think, A, that's true. B, so is what Rob Drouse just said. And the other part also is that we've had this conversation on the air before, and it's some people look at it, and some very kind of scholarly journals will say there is an internal genocide happening. And how do you address it? How do you intervene in it? You talk to folks on Safe Streets and what they're trying to do to intervene in the violence in East Baltimore and now in Cherry Hill. I mean, she is to me a symbol of a very deep problem we're facing in this country. This poor child, Mackenzie Elliott.
There aren't a lot of words in my mind to say. My condolences go out to the family and to the community that both have been scarred by violence, by the life of a young one taken away. And I think, you know, there are times, there will be time for, I think, a scholarly or academic way of looking at this thing, but right now I don't have a lot to offer along those lines. That's just, you know, I'm meditating on what this means for that family. And I think sometimes we want to rush through grief and not understand that sense of loss, but, you know, I think we ought to take time to understand what this means for the family.
In a minute, we'll go back to Rob because he's talked with the family, and I just quick reflection, we'll go to break and we'll come back. Ship, and then
as horrible as this incident is, we have to also keep in mind that this is a continuation of what has been going on.
Right.
We need to be outraged about this, but I was just looking at some statistics here. 3 babies have been killed within this last month. There was a 1-year-old on July 1st and a 2-year-old on July 18th. This year alone, as of the 1st of August, there have been 120 homicides in Baltimore. Now, I know the city officials want to say that crime is down, homicides are down compared to last year, but that's still not good enough. We can't rely upon city officials to resolve this alone. We, the people, have to do something. 10 people under the age of 18 are among those who've been killed. Almost all of the homicides are black people. Almost all of them are black males. We have to do something.
Tyrone, we have a couple minutes before we're going to take a break here and come right back.
I believe that it's time for the community, and this echoes what most have said here, for the community to stand up and work with authorities, putting away the issues of the past, working with authorities to take animals like this who would brazenly shoot down a street without regard for, you know, innocence, such as this little girl. We've got to work together to take these people off of the streets and send a message that this is absolutely intolerable, that you will not be sheltered, that you will not, you know, enjoy the culture of anonymity that goes with the drug culture too often if you commit these heinous crimes.
The challenge, though, is that they're not being sheltered, right? It's not that these people don't, A, know who it is, B, are willing to let them go free. What's happening, or what's going to likely happen, is they know who it is, and they're taking it upon themselves to take care of the people involved. And that's a different, that's a very different dynamic. So it's, and that generates, it kind of reproduces the cycle of terror outside and beyond the economy.
I would agree, and that is why I would agree wholeheartedly, and that is why, you know, I suggest that the community work with the authorities to take these people off the street.
This is so multifaceted, it's multi-layered. I want to take a brief break. We're going to come back. Rob Drowse, I want to hear what he's been talking to the family. I want to hear what he says about the family of Mackenzie Elliott. And we're going to break with St. James Infirmary because this is Louis Armstrong's birthday, but appropriate because this particular song is about a tale of a young man cut down in the prime of his life. We'll be right back to continue our conversation about Mackenzie Elliott and what she represents for all of us.
Wherever she may be.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that was William Schumann, a great American composer. He is concerto for piano and small orchestra. He was born on this day in New York City in 1910. And we continue our roundtable here. We're here with Dr. Lawrence Brown, who will stay with us for the next half an hour as we move into Ebola in a few minutes and talk about what that effect's having on America and the world. Tyrone Keyes remains in the studio, author, public affairs strategist, public relations expert. E.R. Shipp, award-winning journalist, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, who's now in residence here at Morgan State University at the Global School of Journalism. Dr. Lisa Spence, associate professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. And joining us by phone is Rob Drowse, who's a member of 300-Man March and lives in Waverly. And let me start with you, Rob, very quickly. If you could just talk to us about your interactions with the family, just as on a personal note.
You know, again, Mark, there's not too much to say. You know, I can't, before this incident, I can't say, you know, I knew the family personally on a deep level, but just a shock. I mean, it, you know, sadness and grief were part of it, but even just seeing them the next day when the media was out, just the shock on their faces that something like this could happen. You know, a three-year-old could be gunned down in mid-afternoon on her porch in a drive-by. Like, you know, this is some out-of-a-movie kind of stuff. And, you know, it just hurt me to see a lot of folks turn out for that. And, you know, typically with a lot of violence in Baltimore, there's a lot of finger-pointing and issues and, you know, the macro policy and drugs and police and the mayor needs to do this and that. And, you know, it hurt to see some of these residents that, you know, have these fingers to point at certain problems, but no real solutions to offer. You know, there's a lot of folks that aren't necessarily engaged in the neighborhoods. And, you know, not to say something like the 300-man march is for everybody, but to have that, there is no replacement for that level of citizen civic engagement and meeting with these guys who, you know, the media paints as these awful, you know, even alleged gang violent gang members in this community. And it's just ridiculous. And I don't know, you know, where these allegations come from, but these are kids. I was 15 and 16 once, and I did a lot of dumb things, but I also had a lot of positive voices in my ear. And I knew there were lines in the sand drawn. And I knew there were a lot of people in my community, not just in my house, who would have more than just strong words for me if I crossed that line. And, you know, we've removed ourselves from that. And, you know, and that's part of what we do on, you know, on the regular weekly marches with the 300 men. We're not out there talking about drug policy and gang violence and this and that and programs you have to get into, but just to show a force of 40, 50 men coming around the corner with just love and handshakes and a positive word. And that's not something you see in Baltimore. You know, and that's what really irks me, you know, and this is, it's emotional, it's tragic, and for a week or two, a lot of folks are going to be sad, and there's a lot of Facebook pages and Twitter nonsense, but what's going to happen in 2 weeks? Who's going to be out there preventing the next Mackenzie Elliott, that next toddler from getting shot, that next 20-year-old college kid? You know, it's we're just so emotional and so wrapped up in the emotional side of things, and no one wants to dig in and put in that work of going out on a Friday night or a Saturday morning and talking to these guys. You know, these kids, they're not hardened criminals. This isn't Al Capone. These are teenagers that make awful decisions because they don't have that positive bend in their ear, telling them what other steps they can take, what other ways to resolve a conflict.
Rob, I'm
sorry. Like earlier,
I'm just interrupting, so we only have a couple minutes left, and I'm going to let our other guests come in for a moment. I mean,
of course.
I just talk about. I think what Rob is saying is real. There's also the public policy aspect of this that's really critical if we're going to have any kind of intervention at all, whether it's drug policy or the money we put into our communities and who's out there and who's working with kids. I mean, very quickly, when I first got to Baltimore, I'm going to keep this quick, and everybody please keep these closing comments quick because we have to move on to our next segment. But when I first got back to Baltimore, we had a thing called the Street Club Worker Service that I was in, a pretrial intervention that I worked for, and that was our job, and they were really effective. But money was put into young men and women being on the corners and in communities, working with people to stem the violence and helping people through it and figuring out how to recreate their lives. We don't invest in our communities that way, and we're not doing it.
I agree, Mark. I don't know what to say to you. I agree. And we all know it's the truth.
I'm Rob. I just want to go around the room very quickly because we do have to take a break here. So very quickly, Tyrone.
Very quickly, there's an argument to be made for free will. I grew up in the shadow, the literal shadow of Coppin State College. And there was a beacon of another choice in that neighborhood. People know that there are other opportunities out there. The short-term solution to this is catch the animal that shot this little girl. The long-term solutions are going to take the community as a whole to debate.
Often we leave out masculinity, and I talk about that a lot.
Yes, you do.
And I still think that we as men don't look at what manhood means for us and how we can disconnect manhood from violence and power and dominance.
And in addition to all of that, which I concur with, I think we also need to look at all these houses of worship in Baltimore. They are sitting there as beacons of something. They should become more actively engaged so that they are safe havens for young people. They are alternatives. They can also help establish a sense of moral values. But I would like to see them becoming a much bigger player in this whole thing.
Lester.
Yeah, I just want to go back to the idea of emotional outrage. I think one of the things that Facebook and Twitter and social media make possible is the use of social outrage. It shunts off emotions in ways that are productive in some ways because everybody has to express grief. But in the long term, political change is not driven just by emotion. So to the extent, and that goes right back to the idea that in 2 weeks we're going to be outraged about something else. In focusing on policy, what we have to kind of muster the institutional will to do, whether through churches or through other institutions, is to do the mundane, unemotional, non-emotional, anti-emotional work of figuring out how do we build a movement to make selling drugs legal, basically. And that gets rid of most, if not all, of this stuff.
Well, I'm going to thank all of you for being here. And as I said off mic, that we're doing our show today, and the rest of the week we'll have some archives and guest hosts like Lawrence Brown coming in. I'll be out taking care of some family stuff that I have to deal with. When we do come back, we're really going to hit this in a major way again, because I think we have to wrestle with this, both as policy, both as citizens of this city, and have community responses, public responses, and I think I'm one who does believe that through public policy and being engaged and being part of the solution, we can come to grips with this. We have to, because it's the future that's being gunned down in our streets and put into our prisons. So I want to thank all of our guests here. Rob Drowse, thank you so much for joining us. Lawrence Brown, I know you're sticking with us. Mm-hmm. Thanks for being here. Tyrone Keyes, great to have you back on our forums. Really is
great to be back.
Your ship, always lovely to have you in the studio. You're add some more substance here. And Dr. Spence, same to you. Thank you so much, my friend. And we'll come back to all this in a bit. We're going to take a break. As we go to break, we are listening to Masula by Amumu Sangare. We're going to come back to talk about Ebola, what that means in West Africa, what it means to the world. Stay with us. We'll be right back.